Government officials are forecasting a turbulent future for the nation's weather satellite program. Federal budget cuts are threatening to leave the U.S. without some critical satellites. And as NPR's John Hamilton reports, that would mean less accurate warnings about everything from tornadoes to blizzards.
Most of the weather maps you see on TV or online are created with data from government satellites. Catherine Sullivan is Deputy Administrator for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. She says when you hear a long-term weather forecast, it's usually based on data from special NOAA satellites that orbit over the North and South Poles.
The backbone of that forecast 2 days and beyond, any outlook 2 days and beyond, the backbone is the polar satellite system.
Sullivan says that system allows people and businesses to plan much farther ahead than they could in the past.
So, for example, the tornado outbreak late April in Alabama and Mississippi, with the numerical weather forecast guidance, with the polar satellites currently in place, we were able to give those communities 5 days heads up.
But Sullivan says that sort of precision could diminish in the next few years. One important NOAA satellite in a polar orbit will reach the end of its expected life around 2016, and its replacement has been delayed by across-the-board budget cuts. Sullivan says that means there could be more than a year when the nation is lacking a crucial eye in the sky.
If we go blind, if there actually is a gap between the last satellite and this, it certainly will erode the reliability and accuracy of our forecasts.
To find out how much, NOAA re-examined one of its great forecasting successes, the 2010 blizzard known as Snowmageddon. Jack Hayes directs the National Weather Service. He says the agency wanted to know what would happen if something like Snowmageddon arrived several years from now, when several satellites are likely to be out of commission.
We're quite surprised at the finding that we would underestimate the amount of snowfall the eastern seaboard had, specifically in the Washington, D.C. area, by a factor of 2, 50% less.
Hayes says budget problems aren't the only reason NOAA's next polar satellite is behind schedule. There have also been problems getting some of its cutting-edge technology finished on time. But Hayes says this sort of technology is what's made forecasting more accurate with each new generation of satellites. NASA plays an important role in building those satellites and also provides data from some of its own research satellites to NOAA. Michael Freilich, who directs the Earth Science Division at NASA, says the U.S. has come to depend on reliable forecasts.
It used to be that weather was just something that happened. None of us deal with weather that way.
Freilich says nowadays, when forecasters say it's going to rain in 3 or 4 days, we change travel plans.
When they say that it's going to be hot and sunny, people make economic decisions, companies make economic decisions, allocation of electrical resources and everything on that basis.
Freilich says airlines, utilities, local governments, and insurance companies rely heavily on the forecasting data that polar satellites provide. And Catherine Sullivan from NOAA says forecasting in the U.S. is more complicated than it is in most places.
The United States, by virtue of our size, the mountains, the oceans on three sides, we have the widest array and greatest frequency of weather phenomena and severe weather phenomena of any country on the planet.
Sullivan says NOAA wants to tweak its current budget to minimize delays to the polar satellite program. Congress will decide whether they can and what happens to next year's satellite budget. John Hamilton, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Astronomers say they may be seeing the last dying gasps of a star as it is being gobbled up by a massive black hole. The evidence? Mysterious high-energy gamma-ray bursts, first picked up in March. These high-energy bursts are not uncommon, but this one has lasted far longer than usual, tipping off astronomers that something big was happening about 3.8 billion light-years away. The news was reported in two papers in the journal Science. That, along with another report about a slew of supermassive black holes, previously hidden, existing in the very early universe, means it's time to get an update on all things black hole. And who better to do that than Lawrence Krauss, director of the Arizona State University Origins Project, his latest book, Quantum Man, Richard Feynman's Life in Science. Welcome back to Science Friday, Lawrence.
It's always good to be back, Ira.
Thanks for getting up early, and I know you're in Australia, so.
Yes, it's a good time. It's quite black here, so it's right now, so it's a good time to talk about black holes.
Good. Also joining us is Joshua Bloom, Associate Professor of Astronomy at the University of California, Berkeley, and the lead author of one of those science papers. Thanks for talking with us today, Joshua.
Happy to be here.
Lawrence, let me ask you first. Let's just get grounded a bit and talk about what a black hole is.
Well, simply, a black hole is something that's so massive, the gravity is so great, that the escape velocity from its surface is larger than the speed of light. And since nothing can travel faster than light, nothing can escape, not even light. So it's something that is completely separated from the rest of the universe. And I should say that black holes are a theoretical construct. We see objects that we think are black holes, but we aren't 100% certain. They're just so massive and so dense that according to our theories, they can't be anything else. I should say that they come in all different sizes, and one could imagine black holes down ranging from the size of smaller than an atom up to billions of masses, solar masses, and they have very different properties depending upon their mass, very different densities, we think they form. We're reasonably certain they form at least in one simple way when some kinds of very massive stars collapse, so that there are 10 to 100 solar mass objects that after they burn their nuclear fuel, there's nothing to hold them up, and they collapse down to become a black hole. In fact, it was thought that it was originally impossible for that to happen, and John Wheeler, the physicist, originally argued that shouldn't happen, but eventually came around to realizing it must happen and coined the term black hole in the 1960s. And it's such a wonderful term that it's captured the public's imagination. Mm-hmm.
Joshua Bloom, tell us how you came to the conclusion that a giant black hole had gobbled up a star.
Well, we arrived at that through a bunch of different observations that allow us to put this picture together. It was the energy, it was the time over which this event called Swift 1644 plus 57, probably easiest just to call it the event, because it's a bit of a mouthful. The spectrum that we observed across the electromagnetic spectrum, and in fact the location of this one event near the center of a distant and quite anonymous galaxy, all of those pieces of evidence led us to believe that what we're seeing is indeed a black hole swallowing a wayward star as it happened to get too close to that black hole. And the black hole beamed a jet of light and particles at us at Earth, which is why we saw these high-energy gamma rays. It's one of the sort of counterintuitive notions about black holes that I think it's worth bringing up, that we think of them as these cosmic vacuum cleaners in many ways, sucking up everything around them. But actually, around black holes is where we get a tremendous amount of light in the universe. It is an efficient place to change mass into light in an E equals MC squared sense. And so when you have gas swirling around a black hole, that gas gets very, very hot. And before it falls in, it can be seen across the universe.
So what would you have to do then to prove that this is what you're actually seeing?
Well, scientists like to stay away from the word prove just because there's always that little shred of doubt that is actually an important component of what we do. But what we can keep on doing is take more data, and particularly take some data at radio wavelengths. So this is some of the longest radio light and light in the electromagnetic spectrum that we can observe. And this object has been putting out copious radio photons in addition to visible light photons. And we may be able to see a jet emerge from this event over time. It will take a little while for us to be able to actually see it with even the sharpest radio eyes. But that may be one way to really solidify it for the community. There are other possibilities out there of what this could be, but it's the combination of all the observations we have now that really are, I think, starting to make this picture a bit stronger. One of the predictions of what it is that we're seeing, indeed if this is a black hole swallowing up a star, is that this event should never happen again. I think it's worth thinking about black holes and the life cycle of black holes, not just in their sizes and in their masses, but in what they do to the surroundings. Many black holes are sitting there essentially dormant. The black hole at the center of the Milky Way, for instance, is considered to be a dormant black hole that is not gobbling up lots of gas around it. It's not gobbling up nothing, but it's much less than many other black holes, about 10% of them, that have a tremendous amount of gas swirling around them, producing what are commonly called as active galactic nuclei, or quasars. And those black holes, we might think of their eating habits as ones of essentially voracious eaters with voracious appetites that last for millions or tens of millions of years. But the black hole that gave rise to this event that we're interested in was something more of a picky eater.
It's hard for us to understand and think that you're saying it would never happen again. That's an absolute, you said that scientists never speak in.
Well, it's a prediction, and when I should qualify never, I should say never in our lifetime or in mankind's lifetime, a prediction that this event should never happen from that galaxy again, because the chances of a star getting too close to a black hole are actually pretty small. We think from theoretical understanding and actually from some other observational constraints that this should only happen about once per supermassive black hole per million years. So that is, you'd have to look at a million galaxies in 1 year just to see one of these sorts of events. Now, this event was even stranger than that one in a million, in that we had a very special vista on that event where the jet was pointing at us and not some other random direction.
Let me get a reaction. In a short time we have, Lawrence, what do you think? Do you think this is possible?
Well, what's amazing about the universe is that it's big and old, and anything that isn't ruled out by the laws of physics happens all the time. As it was just pointed out, this is a rare event, so people may say, well, how can you believe a one in a million event? But the point is, there are 400 billion galaxies in the universe, and that we can see with telescopes, and therefore rare events happen all the time. It may be rare in any one galaxy, but if we look at enough galaxies, we might see them. And we've discovered that the universe is stranger than we almost ever could have imagined. And anything that isn't ruled out happens. And as was pointed out, what may surprise some of your listeners is everyone thinks of sort of black holes as cosmic vacuum cleaners, that if everything falls into one that's near one. But it's not the case. In fact, you could orbit around a black hole and not fall in. And black holes very effectively clear out the neighborhood around them. And after that, things that are moving far away from them don't fall in. And you have to be heading straight towards them to fall in. Otherwise, you orbit around them just like you would the sun. So these kind of things are indeed rare. But it's amazing that every time we open a new window on the universe, such as the new window we're seeing here, we're surprised.
Well, in the minute or so I have left, another new window that was opened is a team of astronomers saying that they have found the oldest black holes yet from the early beginning of our universe.
Yeah, it's amazing because what was just pointed out is true, that most galaxies nowadays, when we look at them, many of them have large black holes in their center, we think, including our Milky Way. We look towards the center of the Milky Way, we see stars orbiting around something that we can't see, and they're orbiting so fast that the only thing we can understand to explain it is a million solar mass black hole in the center of our galaxy. But what the astronomers have just seen looking for X-rays is a suggestion that even the earliest galaxies that were just forming in the universe may have had million or tens of million mass solar black holes. And that opens the question, the chicken and egg question. Were the black holes necessary for the galaxies to form? Or were the galaxies necessary for the black holes to form, or were they necessary for each other to develop? And those are the kind of questions we're going to begin to answer as we look at the earlier and earlier universe.
One last question for you, Dr. Bloom. Where do you go from here?
Well, I think we need to understand whether we have actually seen an event like this from another galaxy in the past. There's great historical archives at high energy wavelengths taken by many satellites over the last several decades. Now that we know what to look for, we need to ask that question, have we actually seen this before but never recognized it? And if we haven't, that gives us a pretty good handle on how often this sort of event happens. If we've seen it, then it allows us to start actually doing some sort of demographic studies of these. How were the other events different from this one? It allows us to get, a very nice picture of how black holes in this very interesting eating channel, swallowing up stars rather than gobbling up gas, how it is that they actually grow. How often does this event actually happen? And try to nail that down.
And Lawrence, what's a big question you'd like to know about black holes that are unanswered? Question.
Well, I'd really like to know if they're really black holes. As I say, everything we can see is indirect. And right now we say if it walks like a duck and talks like a duck or quacks like a duck, it's a duck. And these things look and act like black holes, but we haven't yet seen the really smoking gun that tells us that our theoretical understanding of gravity at its extreme limit is really true. And that would one day be wonderful. We're not there yet.
All right. I want to thank both you gentlemen for taking time to be with us, especially you, Lawrence, out in Australia for getting up or staying late or whatever you did.
Pleasure.
Lawrence Krauss is director of the Arizona State University Origins Project. His latest book is Quantum Man, Richard Feynman's Life in Science. Joshua Bloom, associate professor of astronomy, University of California at Berkeley, and lead author of one of those science papers about black holes in this week's edition of Science. Thank you, gentlemen. Have a good weekend.
Thank you very much.
Happy Father's Day to you. We've run out of time for this segment. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to switch gears and talk about using stem cells. Can and are stem cells being used to treat illnesses? And one special case, famous case of New York Yankees pitcher Bartolo Colon, who went out of the country to get a treatment. But we'll learn that it's more common than you think it is. We'll have some details after this break, so stay with us.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, we'll talk to the author of a new book that captures, we don't want to say every parent's frustration, maybe many parents' frustration when it's time to put the kids to bed. But first, you might have seen the scenes of street protests in Greece over austerity measures being proposed to address the economic crisis. That sound is from the riots that broke out in Athens over recent efforts by the Greek government to deal with its massive debt problems. The government is debating budget cuts that are meant to satisfy the European Union, which is in turn arguing over whether to help Greece with a bailout worth tens of billions of dollars. And you might have thought, well, that's really interesting, but what does that have to do with me? It turns out it might. And here to tell us how is Robin Farzad, senior writer at Bloomberg Businessweek. Robin, welcome back. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
First, could you just tell us, how did Greece get to this point?
You know,
and how bad is it?
It's bad in that there was a lot of denial that led up into this. You know, 5 short years ago, everybody thought that Greece and all these countries in Europe were good for the money because they were living under this EU halo. French investors were investing in Greek debt. Risk spreads were going down. They're like, everybody's good for the money because this coalition thing is going pretty darn well. Then the economy tanks. And then obviously when that happens, you realize that exposes all sorts of book cooking and the like. And Greece, it is alleged, you know, really cooked the books to kind of make itself look a bit more healthy, like it was taking in more revenue than it actually had. And this made its government popular there. But when it didn't have the money to pay the unions and to pay the teachers and to pay the public transit workers, suddenly it had an enormous budget deficit, and here we are.
So there's already been one bailout, correct?
Yes.
And now they're seeking a second bailout.
Yes. Okay. And I think it shows that I think the entire continent and subcontinent vastly underestimated how severe this was. I mean, they went to the trough once. When you do something like this, ideally you want to cordon off the contagion. And it is so bad, the deficit is so huge over there, and the Greek government's promises of austerity were so ill-received by the masses there that suddenly they are facing down the possibility of a default, which is absolutely unthinkable for a country the size of Greece.
So, Robin, the EU is obviously an important trading partner to the U.S. How important a trading partner is it, and what are the implications of a financial failure in Greece to that relationship?
You know, the United States in this position at a time where it is especially dependent on exports, whatever we still do export because the U.S. consumer is so weak, can ill afford to have Europe in crisis, whether if there's a systemic problem and banks start failing and then you have companies reneging on their orders and whatnot. This is something that we need like a bullet in our heads at this point. So you are hoping that this doesn't recourse back to American manufacturers. And again, we are all connected. You look at how the Japanese tsunami hurt American manufacturers. They're still blaming it in their financial reports. This could ripple across the pond. If German and French banks are on the hook, suddenly American banks are on the hook because we trade with all of these multinational banks in Paris and Berlin and in London. And the whole world likes to think that China is controlling everything right now, but disproportionately the German and French economies are trading partners with us, and we don't want to see them subsumed by some systemic banking crisis that doesn't make them good for the money.
Rabbi Farzad is a senior writer for Bloomberg Businessweek, talking to us about the latest in the Greek debt crisis. And he joined us from our bureau in New York. Rabbi, thanks so much for joining us once again.
My pleasure.
Well, that is not the only issue of national security policy that's proving contentious this week. Congressional Republicans have also challenged the administration over the War Powers Act. They say the president is exceeding his authority in Libya. That is one topic for our regular commentators, David Brooks of the New York Times and E.J. Dionne of the Washington Post and the Brookings Institution. Good to see both of you.
Good to be with you.
Let's start. E.J., what do you make of the House Republicans finding long-lost common ground with Congressman Dennis Kucinich over the War Powers Act?
Politics is a wonderful thing, isn't it? I mean, the Republican Party has always had a strong anti-interventionist wing. Some people call it an isolationist wing, going back to the days of Robert Taft. It sort of went away in the anti-communist years, then it came back. And a lot of Republicans didn't like the intervention in Kosovo or Bosnia under Clinton. When George Bush became president, it became a party line position to support intervention abroad. And so what I think you're seeing is a lot of Republicans, both libertarian kinds of Republicans and more traditionalists, returning to their old positions of being against sending American troops. And, of course, anything connected with President Obama is not popular among Republicans.
David, you see it that way?
Well, parties out of power are always less interventionist than parties in power, because when you're in power, you know you have to do things. You're America. You're the global superpower. When you're out of power, it's just easier to complain about how much it's costing. And so that's true, I think, universally. I'm not a huge fan of the War Powers Act, but the Obama administration's argument that what we're doing in Libya is not, quote, hostilities, is kind of ludicrous and laughable. And so I wish they would just consult. You don't have to go through the whole War Powers rigmarole, but just once in a while pick up the phone and talk to members of Congress, bring them into the process. You wouldn't have all these problems.
You think this might have been avoided?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that there is a responsibility for the executive. And for goodness sake, Democrats were very unhappy about what they saw as unilateral actions by the Bush administration. I think it's reasonable when a new Democratic president is in power, even if he believes he has to act, that he should honor the fact that Congress does have some role in this.
But in Monday's Republican presidential debate, rather, up in New Hampshire, we heard people talking about the world. And, David, it sounded like that old Republican Party EJ is talking about.
Yeah, I'm a little dubious it'll actually be that way when in power. Like I said, it's easy to criticize. And, you know, we're always on the lookout for isolationism in this country. It never actually arrives.
But I think that there was a kind of reckless interventionism in the Bush years, and it's created a backlash. And the other thing is Americans are simply exhausted from fighting two wars over 10 years. A lot of Americans want this to end, and the Republicans are speaking to that.
I'm going to get insular now. Let's turn to domestic matters. And there seems to be a very broad agreement that the country's biggest problem at this moment is the recovery is not generating enough jobs. So if jobs is seen as the huge problem of the day, do you hear any huge or appropriate solutions being talked about out there? David?
No. There's really nothing short term. We've just had the world historical size stimulus. It's had some effect, but sort of a disappointing effect. The deeper problem is really structural. Small business formation has been dropping for the last 30 years. Male wages have been stagnant for 30 years. What it requires is a very big and long-term agenda, which crosses the partisan lines. Republicans are probably right that we need to transfer money from Medicare and old people to young people in innovation. Democrats are right. We need to invest in basic research. We need to invest in infrastructure and things like that. But getting one party to have a transpartisan growth agenda is very hard in this climate.
I think you need to do some immediate things, except for the part about killing Medicare. Of course, that's not what David said. I agree with a lot of what he said. But there was a meeting of Senate Democrats, a lunch last week, where they kicked around what can we plausibly do to boost the economy that has any chance of getting through a Republican House and a Senate where Republicans can block anything. And basically, they decided mostly what you can get through are tax cuts, which is why continuing The payroll tax cut that started last year for another year is in the mix. They're also talking about tax breaks to encourage energy efficiency. But there is a shot at passing a decent public works bill and perhaps even the infrastructure bank. We ought to be investing in ourselves at a time when interest rates are so low and when we need jobs.
Well, you'd have to show some budget discipline. You look at what's happening in Greece. You look at nervousness about debt all around the world. If we could show some long-term budget discipline, then the short-term stuff would be possible. Right now, really, we're no prospect of doing more spending, more tax cuts.
Well, what hopes do the two of you have that the negotiations between Vice President Biden, the administration more broadly, and Republicans on the Hill could put together some kind of bipartisan package that might make someone more confident about the country's prospects?
I'm very gloomy on this. I think the markets are vastly underappreciating the amount of political risk here. I think they could come up with some sort of B-minus solution where they pretend to some shallow spending or deficit caps, which really push the problem off. I think it's much more likely that there will be a significant defaults, crack-up, semi-government shutdown, something the markets haven't yet paid attention to. But I'd be very pessimistic about what's going to happen in Washington over the next couple months.
EJ?
David and I seem to switch sides on optimism and pessimism. I think that there will be some kind of deal that will at least look like a couple of billion dollars in cuts so they can pass
a couple of trillion dollars
in cuts so they can get the debt ceiling approved. It'll include things that won't make people excited, like accepting the wars will end and counting a trillion dollars from that. I think they know they got to get a deal, and I think they'll get something, but the long-term solution won't happen until after the next election.
Trillion, billion, what's the difference?
There we go.
David Brooks of the New York Times, E.J. Dunn of the Washington Post, thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And now we want to tell you about a hilarious new take on that age-old problem, getting the beloved child to go to sleep. Is there a manual they slip those kids in the sandbox to teach them how to stall? If you're a parent or caregiver of a young child, you know what I'm talking about. The whining, the demands for juice, for one more hug. You can admit it. No matter how much you love the little person, doesn't it make you want to cuss? That frustration is captured in a beautifully drawn new book by Adam Mansbach, the title of which I cannot actually tell you because it includes what most would consider as one very bad word. And Adam Mansbach is here with us. Welcome to the program. Please don't jeopardize our FCC license.
I wouldn't dream of it.
Now, we're going to bleep it, but you tell me the title of the book and tell me how it came about.
The name of the book is Go the F*** to Sleep. And it all really started with some sleepless nights of my own. I have a 3-year-old daughter who was 2 then. Her name is Vivian. And one night after putting her to bed, I wrote a post on Facebook that said, "Look out for my forthcoming children's book, Go the F*** to Sleep," which I had no intention of writing at the time. But a couple of weeks passed, and I made the joke a few more times in person and sat down and wrote it.
This is a story about a book, but it's also an amazing story about social media because the book isn't even out yet, and it's already been a number one seller on Amazon.com. How did that happen? It's word of mouth, social media?
Yeah, a combination of a lot of things. We were sort of in the middle of a weirdly perfect storm. I gave a reading of the book on April 23rd in Philadelphia to about 200 people at an art salon, really just to see how the audience responded. I hadn't read the book publicly before, and at the time it was supposed to come out in October. And the response was tremendous, and people, I think, went home and pre-ordered it that night. So by the next morning, it was charting pretty high, or pretty low, I guess you would say, on Amazon's rankings. It was number 125. I'm a literary novelist. I've never even seen a number that low, you know? Like, literary fiction is supposed to be at a respectable 700,000. So from there, things got crazy.
I'm going to read a short passage from the book, but I'm going to leave out the explicit words because, as I mentioned, I would like to be on the air tomorrow as well. The cats nestle close to their kittens now. The lambs have laid down with the sheep. You're cozy and warm in your bed, my dear, so please go to sleep. The windows are dark in the town, child. The whales huddle down in the deep. I'll read you I'll read you one very last book if you swear you'll go to sleep. Now, were you just sitting there cracking yourself up as you worked on this?
Yeah, it was pretty good. I got to say, your reading was excellent. If Samuel Jackson wasn't already doing our audiobook, I would want you to do it.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, it was. I had a lot of fun with it. And I wrote it quickly and I read it to people and they thought it was funny. And And the funny thing is I've had more response from women than from men. It's mothers more than fathers who are loving this book
saying
and buying
what? They're it. Saying what? Finally, somebody.
Yeah, they're saying I feel much less alone. They're saying when I'm in the bedroom trying to put the kid to bed and missing out on dinner or a glass of wine or the only conversation I was going to have that day, I feel much better knowing that there are millions of people across the world dealing with the same problem and thinking the same words, and you've articulated it, and they feel, yeah, I guess it's very cathartic for a lot of them to know that other people feel this way and that it's okay to feel this way. We can laugh about it.
And this, now, obviously, a lot of people think it's hilarious, but there are some people who think it's totally inappropriate. There are some people who've said, in fact, they've posted on the Amazon, you know how Amazon has a section where you can offer comments, where readers can offer comments. And there really are some people who say things like, it's funny, but it's not for kids.
Right.
Or that this is just inappropriate. You shouldn't be even thinking that way. What do you say to that?
I certainly agree that it's not for kids. It even says that on the back of the book. And, you know, in terms of whether you should be thinking that way, I don't think we should be legislating how people think. I think in this case, it's very cathartic for parents to read this because it validates their frustration. And the book is clear on the values that we are putting forth. It's a sort of dual narrative. There's the parent's internal monologue, which is frustrated and full of obscenities. And then there's what the parent is actually saying to the child, which is sweet and loving. So if anything, the book is sort of about containing your frustrations with your kid, who, of course, you love, but who's driving you crazy because it's been 38,000 hours since you've been out of the bedroom.
This book is definitely coming to a baby shower near you. I mean, who are we kidding? But I did want to ask, though, it does sort of speak to one other thing, and I was just wondering if anybody had raised this. There are people who say, what is your problem? What's all this, like, negotiating with the other hug and the water and whatever, whatever? Just,
right.
Like, walk out of the room, yo. What's the problem? Have you ever heard anybody say that? Look,
there's all kinds of strategies out there, and that's certainly one. It's not one that I ever tried because, you know, I'm a big soft at heart. I just curse internally and give in to my child.
Finally, before we let you go, I did want to talk a little bit about your prior work. You're
Thanks.
Known for writing some pretty serious books. Your best-selling Angry Black White Boy is about race and hip-hop. It's being taught at more than 60 colleges and universities and high schools, from what I understand.
Yeah,
there's also The End of the Jews, which has been translated into 5 languages. The Boston Globe called it intense, painful, and poignant. So I'm just wondering, how does that guy come up with go the to sleep?
Yeah, well, you know, what I strive for in all my work is to be honest and to explore the human condition and the paradoxical nature of life. And I've also been lucky enough and made the decision throughout my career as a writer to really just write the books I wanted to write without much thought about audience or commercial saleability. So this is yet another book that is just sort of honest and a book I wanted to write. And I did it without any sort of sense of calculation.
So before we let you go, your daughter Vivian was 2 when you wrote this. How's it going now? Is she going to bed?
It's actually a lot better. She's 3 and she's turned a certain corner. I'm beginning to think that maybe her inability to sleep was because of concern about our family's financial future. So the book may have helped her to figure out that sleep is acceptable now.
Okay. Adam Mansbach is the author of Go the to Sleep and a number of other books. It's about the exasperation that many parents feel when trying to put their children to sleep. And he was kind enough to join us from our bureau in New York. And presumably he's sleeping better now, too. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle.
The last few years have been a rough patch for print journalism. They've been marked by layoffs and technology-induced growing pains, and that makes a vivid backdrop for the new documentary, Page One, A Year Inside the New York Times. Movie critic Bob Mondello has our review.
We've all heard the litany. Newsprint is expensive, circulation is down, ad revenues are declining, and bloggers can do everything faster and cheaper. Dead tree journalism, in short, is on its last legs. Except somehow it staggers on, inspiring the likes of young New York Times reporter Tim Arango to do what generations of reporters have done before him.
A lot of the people in the Baghdad bureau were moving to Kabul, and they asked if there was anybody who wanted to volunteer for Baghdad. And so I'm going to Iraq.
Okay, that's a youthful take on old school. Here's the new wave. Teen blogger turned Times reporter Brian Stelter.
It drives me nuts when I'll hear about it. You know, I'll hear my colleagues talking about a story at noon, and I read it on Twitter at midnight. I'm thinking to myself, why is that allowed? You know, why are we not on top of the news? It's 2010.
I still can't get over the feeling that Brian Stelter was a robot assembled in the basement of New York Times to come and destroy me.
That growl is media reporter David Carr, the cranky, battered, and downright hammy star of Andrew Rossi's documentary. Carr, who, full disclosure, years ago was my editor at Washington City Paper, is the audience's dyspeptic guide to what the director has fashioned as a kind of New York Times reality show. 2010 would have offered drama anywhere in journalism, but at the Times, where more than 100 news staffers were laid off or bought out, editor Bill Keller concedes it went beyond drama to something closer to carnage.
I feel some days that, you know, we should be symbolically wearing, you know, bloody butcher's smocks or something around the newsroom. It's such a kind of grim undertaking.
I came with the high hopes of staying for 1 year. I've overstayed that by 20 years.
The other side of the story is the paper's aggressive attempt to stay in a game it once dominated. In 1971, Daniel Ellsberg needed the New York Times to get the Pentagon Papers out to the public. 40 years later, Julian Assange's WikiLeaks doesn't. So in the film, the Times tries to hitch a ride on the story rather than being the story by interviewing Assange about his process.
Hi, it's Brian Stelter calling from the Times. There's a traditional definition of journalism that is objective, never breaking the law to obtain content. Do you view yourself as trying to achieve that definition?
The journalism is just a tool. We can use a tool to get to the goal.
And tell me what the goal is.
As an editor notes, it's two worlds colliding, the old world of expertise, information, and privacy, and a new world intent on exploding that model. Director Andrew Rossi finds lots of ways to illustrate that collision, following David Carr as he showboats and snarls that the old gray lady still sets the news agenda, and scolds a few internet interlopers who sneer at the media rules the Times helped invent. Page One, A Year Inside the New York Times, is an insider's view. It isn't raking up any muck, but it's not a love letter either. More a portrait of an institution at a moment of transition, when Page One space still qualifies as precious real estate, and the question of whether it'll hang on to that value is, at least for old school journalists, disconcertingly up in the air. I'm Bob Mondello.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.